putting her hands across her belly. "Whereupon you proceeded to say nothing," I observed. "Did your father find out by accident?"
"No. I told him," she said. "I thought I best had before I began to shoe. Joe and Kizzy came with me."
That explained Mr. Weems's resort to strong drink, all right. Perhaps we should have brought the jug back with us.
"Your poor father," I said again, but abstractedly.
"Had the three of you worked out any sort of plan?"
"Well, no," she admitted. "I hadn't told the lads I was in a family way till this morning either. They seemed taken back a bit," she added, biting her lip again.
"I dare say."
I glanced outside. It was still raining, but the downpour had slackened momentarily, dimpling the puddles on the path.
I rubbed a hand over my face, feeling suddenly rather tired.
"Which one will you choose?" I asked.
She gave me a sudden, startled look, the blood draining from her cheeks.
"You can't have them both, you know," I said gently.
"It doesn't work that way."
"Why?" she said, trying for boldness, but her voice trembled. "It's no harming anyone, and it's no one's business but ours."
I began to feel the need of a stiff drink myself.
"Ho, ho," I said. "Try telling your father that, or Mr. Fraser."
"In a big city, perhaps you could get away with it. But here? Everything that happens is everybody's business, and you know it. Hiram Crombie would stone you for fornication as soon as look at you if he found out about it."
Without waiting for a reply, I got to my feet.
"Now then, we'll go back to the house and see whether they're both still alive. Mr. Fraser may have taken matters into his own hands and solved the problem for you." The twins were still alive, but didn't look as though they were particularly glad of the fact. They sat shoulder to shoulder in the centre of Jamie's study, pressed together as though trying to reunite into a single being. Their heads jerked toward the door in unison, looks of alarm and concern mingling with joy at seeing Lizzie. I had her by the arm, but when she saw the twins, she pulled loose and hurried to them with a small exclamation, putting an arm about each boy's neck to draw him to her bosom. I saw that one of the boys had a fresh black eye just beginning to puff and swell. I supposed it must be Kizzy, though I didn't know whether this was Jamie's notion of fairness, or merely a convenient means of ensuring that he could tell which twin was which while talking to them. Mr. Weems was also alive, though he didn't look any more pleased about it than the Beardsleys. He was red-eyed, pale, and still slightly green about the gills, but was at least upright and reasonably sober, seated beside Jamie's table. There was a cup of chicory coffee in front of him. I could smell it, but it seemed so far untouched. Lizzie knelt on the floor, still clinging to the boys, the three heads drawn together like the lobes of a clover leaf, as they murmured to one another. "Are you hurt?" she was saying, and, "Are you all right?" they were asking, an absolute tangle of hands and arms, meanwhile searching, patting, stroking, and embracing. They reminded me of nothing so much as a tenderly solicitous octopus. I glanced at Jamie, who was viewing this behaviour with a jaundiced eye. Mr. Weems emitted a low moan and buried his head in his hands. Jamie cleared his throat with a low Scottish noise of infinite menace, and the proceedings, in the middle of the room, stopped as though hit with some sort of paralysing death ray. Very slowly, Lizzie turned her head to look at him, chin held high, her arms still locked protectively about the Beardsleys' necks.
"Sit down, lass," Jamie said, with relative mildness, nodding toward an empty stool.
Lizzie rose and turned, her eyes still fixed on him. She made no move to take the offered stool, though. Instead, she walked deliberately round behind the twins and stood between them, putting her hands upon their shoulders.
"I'll stand, sir," she said,
her voice high and thin with fear, but filled with determination. Like clockwork, Each twin reached up and grasped the hand upon his shoulder, their faces assuming similar expressions of mingled apprehension and steadfastness. Jamie wisely decided not to make an issue of it, instead nodding to me in an offhand way. I took the stool myself, surprisingly glad to sit down.
"The lads and I have been talking with your father," he said, addressing Lizzie. "I take it it's true what you told your da. You are with child, and you dinna ken which is the father."
Lizzie opened her mouth, but no words came out. Instead, she bobbed her head in an awkward nod.
"Aye, well then, you'll need to be wed, and the sooner the better,"
he said, in a matter-of-fact tone of voice.
"The lads couldn't quite decide which of them it should be, so it's up to you, lass. Which one?"
All six hands tightened in a flash of white knuckles. It was really quite fascinating, and I couldn't help feeling sorry for the three of them. "I can't," Lizzie whispered. Then she cleared her throat and tried again. "I can't," she repeated more strongly. I don't want to choose. I love them both." Jamie looked down at his clasped hands for a moment, lips pursing as he thought. Then he raised his head and looked at her very levelly. I saw her draw herself upright, lips pressed together, trembling but resolute, determined to defy him. Then, with truly diabolical timing, Jamie turned to Mr. Weems. "Joseph," he said mildly. Mr. Weems had been sitting transfixed, eyes on his daughter, pale hands wrapped round his coffee cup. He didn't hesitate, though, or even blink.
"Elizabeth," he said,
his voice very soft.
"Do you love me?"
Her facade of defiance broke like a dropped egg, tears welling from her eyes.
"Oh, da," she said.
She let go the twins and ran to her father, who stood up in time to clasp her tightly in his arms, cheek pressed to her hair. She clung to him, sobbing, and I heard a brief sigh from one of the twins, though I couldn't tell which one. Mr. Weems swayed gently with her, patting and soothing her, his murmured words indistinguishable from her sobs and broken utterances. Jamie was watching the twins, not without sympathy. Their hands were knotted together, and Kezie's teeth were fixed in his lower lip. Lizzie separated herself from her father, sniffling and groping vaguely for a handkerchief. I pulled one from my pocket, got up, and gave it to her. She blew her nose hard and wiped her eyes, trying not to look at Jamie. She knew very well where the danger lay. It was, however, a fairly small room, and Jamie wasn't a person who could be easily ignored, even in a large one. Unlike my surgery, the windows of the study were small and placed high in the wall, which gave the room, under normal circumstances, a pleasant dim cosiness. At the moment, with the rain still coming down outside, a grey light filled the room, and the air was chill.
"It's no matter of whom you love now, lass," Jamie said, very gently. "Not even your father."
He nodded toward her stomach.
"You've a child in your belly. Nothing else matters but to do right by it. And that doesn't mean painting its mother a whore, aye?"
Her cheeks flamed a patchy crimson. "I'm not a whore."
"I didn't say you were," Jamie replied calmly. "But others will. And it gets around what you've been up to, lass. Spreading your legs for two men, and married to neither of them. And now with a wean, and you canna name its father."
She looked angrily away from him, and saw her own father, head bowed, his own cheeks darkening in shame. She made a small, heartbroken sound, and buried her face in her hands. The twins stirred uneasily, glancing at each other, and Joe got his feet under him to rise, then caught a look of wounded reproach from Mr. Weems, and changed his mind. Jamie sighed heavily and rubbed a knuckle down the bridge of his nose. He stood then, stooped to the hearth, and pulled two straws from the basket of kindling. Holding these in his fist,
He held them out to the twins.
"Short straw weds her," he said, with resignation.
The twins gaped at him, open-mouthed.
Then Kezzy, swallowed visibly, closed his eyes, and plucked a straw gingerly, as though it might be attached to something explosive.
Joe kept his eyes open, but didn't look at the straw he'd drawn. His eyes were fixed on Lizzie. Everyone seemed to exhale at once, looking at the straws.
"Very well, then. Stand up," Jamie said to Kezzy, who held the short one.
Looking dazed, he did so.
"Take her hand," Jamie told him patiently. "Now, do you swear before these witnesses?"
He nodded at me and Mr. Weems.
"That you take Elizabeth Weems as your wife."
Kezzy nodded, then cleared his throat and drew himself up.
"I do so," he said firmly. "And do you, you wee bism, accept Keziah?"
"You are Keziah," he asked,
squinting dubiously at the twin. "Aye, all right, Keziah. You'll take him as your husband?"
"Aye,"
Lizzie said, sounding hopelessly confused.
"Good," Jamie said briskly. "Your hand fast. Directly we find a priest, we'll have it properly blessed. But you're married."
He looked at Joe, who had risen to his feet.
"And you," he said firmly, "you'll leave. Tonight. You'll no come back till the child is born."
Joe was white to the lips, but nodded. He had both hands pressed to his body, not where Jamie had hit him, but higher, over his heart. I felt a sharp answering pain in the same place, seeing his face.
"Well, then."
Jamie took a deep breath, his shoulders slumping a little.
"Joseph, have you still got the marriage contract you drew for your daughter and young McGillivray? Fetch it out, aye, and we'll change the name."
Looking like a snail poking its head out after a thunderstorm, Mr. Weems nodded cautiously. He looked at Lizzie, still standing hand in hand with her new bridegroom, the two of them resembling Lot and Mrs. Lot, respectively. Mr. Weems patted her softly on the shoulder and hurried out, his feet tapping on the stairs.
"You'll need a fresh candle, won't you?"
I said to Jamie, tilting my head meaningfully toward Lizzie and the twins. The stub in his candlestick had half an inch to go, but I thought it only decent to give them a few moments of privacy.
"Oh? Oh, aye," he said, catching my meaning.
He coughed.
"I'll come and get it."
The moment we entered my surgery, he closed the door and leaned against it and let his head fall, shaking it.
"Oh, God," he said.
"Poor things," I said, with some sympathy. "I mean, you do have to feel sorry for them."
"I do?"
He sniffed at his shirt, which had dried but still had the distinct stain of vomit down the front, then straightened up, stretching till his back creaked.
"Aye, I suppose I do," he admitted. "But, oh God, did she tell you how it happened?"
"Yes, I'll tell you the gory details later." I heard Mr. Weems' feet coming down the stairs. I took down a fresh pair of candles from the array that hung near the ceiling and held them out, stretching the long wick that joined them. "Do you have a knife handy?" His hand went automatically to his waist, but he wasn't wearing his dirk.
"No, there's a penknife on my desk, though."
He opened the door just as Mr. Weems reached the office. Mr. Weems's exclamation of shock reached me simultaneously with the smell of blood. Jamie pushed Mr. Weems unceremoniously aside, and I rushed in after him, heart in my throat. The three of them were standing by the desk, close together. A spray of fresh blood stained the desk, and Kezzy was holding my bloodied handkerchief wrapped round his hand. He looked up at Jamie, his face ghostly in the guttering light. His teeth were gritted tight together, but he managed a smile. A small movement caught my eye, and I saw Joe carefully holding the blade of Jamie's penknife over the candle flame. Acting as though no one was there, he took his brother's hand, pulled off the handkerchief, and pressed the hot metal against the raw oval of the wound on Kezzy's thumb. Mr. Weems made a small choking noise, and the smell of seared flesh mixed with the scent of rain. Kezzy drew breath deeply, then let it out, and smiled crookedly at Joe.
"Godspeed, brother," he said, his voice a little loud and flat. "Much happiness to you, brother," Joe said, in the same voice.
Lizzie stood between them, small and dishevelled, her reddened eyes fixed on Jamie, and smiled. Chapter 74. So romantic. Brianna drove the little car slowly up the slope of the quilt over Roger's leg, across his stomach, and into the centre of his chest, where he captured both the car and her hand, giving her a wry grin. "That's a really good car," she said, pulling her hand loose and rolling comfortably onto her side beside him. "All four wheels turn. What kind is it? A Morris Minor, like that little orange thing you had in Scotland?"
"That was the cutest thing I ever saw, but I never understood how you managed to squeeze into it." "With talcum powder," he assured her.
He lifted the toy and set a front wheel spinning with a flick of his thumb.
"Aye, it is a good one, isn't it? It isn't really meant to be a particular model, but I suppose I was remembering that Ford Mustang of yours. Remember driving down out of the mountains that time?"
His eyes softened with memory, the green of them nearly black in the dim light of the banked fire.
"I do. I nearly drove off the road when you kissed me at 85 miles per hour.
She moved closer to him by reflex, nudging him with a knee. He rolled obligingly to face her and kissed her again, meanwhile running the car swiftly backward down the length of her spine and over the curve of her buttocks. She yelped and squirmed against him, trying to escape the tickling wheels, then punched him in the ribs.
"Cut that out!" "I thought you found speed erotic." "Vroom," he murmured, steering the toy up her arm and suddenly down the neck of her shift.
She grabbed for the car, but he snatched it away, then plunged his hand under the covers, running the wheels down her thigh, then madly up again. A furious wrestling match for possession of the car ensued, which ended with both of them on the floor in a tangle of bedding and nightclothes, gasping for breath and helpless with giggling.
"Shh! You'll wake up Jemmy!"
She heaved and wriggled, trying to get out from under Roger's weight. Secure in his 50 pounds advantage, he merely relaxed on top of her, pinning her to the floor.
"You couldn't awake him with cannon fire," Roger said,
with a certainty born of experience. It was true. Once past the stage of waking to be fed every few hours, Jem had always slept like a particularly comatose log. She subsided, puffing hair out of her eyes and biding her time.
"Do you think you'll ever go anywhere at 85 miles per hour again?" "Only if I fall off the edge of a very deep gorge." "You're naked. Did you know that?"
"Well, so are you."
"Aye, but I started out that way. Where's the car?"
"I have no idea," she lied. It was, in fact, under the small of her back and very uncomfortable, but she wasn't about to give him any further advantages. "What do you want it for?"
"Oh, I was just going to explore the terrain a bit," he said, raising himself on one elbow and walking his fingers slowly across the upper slope of one breast. "I suppose I could do it on foot, though. Takes more time. But you do enjoy the scenery more, they say."
He could hold her down with his weight, but couldn't restrain her arms. She extended one index finger and placed the nail of it precisely on his nipple, making him breathe in deeply.
"Did you have a long journey in mind?"
She glanced at the small shelf near the bed, where she kept her contraceptive materials.
"Long enough."
He followed her glance, then looked back to meet her eyes, a question in his own. She wriggled to make herself more comfortable, unobtrusively dislodging the miniature car.
"They say a journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step," she said,
and raising her head, put her mouth on his nipple and closed her teeth gently. A moment later, she let go.
"Be quiet,"
she said reproachfully.
"You'll wake up, Jemmy."
"Where are your scissors? I'm cutting it off."
"I'm not telling you. I like it long." She pushed the soft, dark hair back from his face and kissed the end of his nose, which appeared to disconcert him slightly. He smiled, though, and kissed her briefly back before sitting up, swiping the hair out of his face with one hand.
"That can't be comfortable,"
he said, eyeing the cradle.
"Surely I should move him to his own bed."
Brianna glanced up at the cradle from her position on the floor. Jemmy, aged 4, had long since graduated to a trundle bed, but now and then insisted upon sleeping in his cradle for old time's sake, wedging himself stubbornly into it, despite the fact that he couldn't get all 4 limbs and his head inside at once. He was invisible at the moment, save for 2 chubby bare legs sticking straight up in the air at one end. He was getting so big, she thought. He couldn't quite read yet, but knew all his letters, and could count to 100, and write his name. And he knew how to load a gun. His grandfather had taught him. "Do we tell him?" she asked suddenly. "And if so, when?" Roger must have been thinking something along the same lines, for he appeared to understand exactly what she meant.
"Christ, how do you tell a kid something like that?" he said.
He rose and picked up a handful of bedding, shaking it in apparent hopes of finding the leather string with which he bound his hair. "Wouldn't you tell a kid if he were adopted?" she objected, sitting up and running both hands through her own bountiful hair. "Or if there's some family scandal, like his father's not dead, he's in prison. If you tell them early, it doesn't mean all that much to them, I don't think. They're comfortable with it as they get older. If they find out later, it's a shock." He gave her a wry, sidelong look.
"You'd know."
"So would you." She spoke dryly, but she felt the echo of it even now. Disbelief, anger, denial. And then the sudden collapse of her world as she began, against her will, to believe. The sense of hollowness and abandonment, and the sense of black rage and betrayal at discovering how much of what she had taken for granted was a lie. "At least for you, it wasn't a choice," she said, squirming into a more comfortable position against the edge of the bed. "Nobody knew about you. Nobody could have told you what you were, but didn't."
"Oh, and you think they should have told you about the time travel early on? Your parents?"
He lifted one black brow, cynically amused.
"I can see the notes coming home from your school. Brianna has a most creative imagination, but should be encouraged to recognize situations where it is not appropriate to employ it."
"Ha!" She kicked away the remaining tangle of clothes and bedding. "I went to a Catholic school. The nuns would have called it lying and put a stop to it, period. Where's my shift?" She had wriggled completely out of it in the struggle, and while she was still warm from their struggle, she felt uncomfortably exposed, even in the dim shadows of the room.
"Here it is."
He plucked a wad of linen from the mess and shook it out.
"Do you?"
he repeated, looking up at her with one brow raised. "Think they should have told me? Yes." "And no," she admitted reluctantly. She reached for the shift and pulled it over her head. "I mean, I see why they didn't. Daddy didn't believe it to start with. And what he did believe... well, whatever it was, he did ask Mama to let me think he was my real father. She gave him her word. I guess I don't think she should have broken it. No." To the best of her knowledge, her mother had broken her word only once, unwillingly, but to staggering effect. She smoothed the worn linen over her body and fished for the ends of the drawstring that gathered the neck. She was covered now, but felt just as much exposed as if she were still naked. Roger was sitting on the mattress, methodically shaking out the blankets, but his eyes were still fixed on her, green and questioning. "It was still a lie," she burst out. "I had a right to know." He nodded slowly.
"Mm-hmm."
He picked up a rope of twisted sheet and began unwinding it.
"Ah, well, I can see telling a kid he's adopted or his dad's in prison. This is maybe more along the lines of telling a kid his father murdered his mother when he found her screwing the postie and six good friends in the kitchen, though. Maybe it doesn't mean that much to him if you tell him early on. But it's definitely going to get the attention of his friends when he starts telling them. She bit her lip, feeling unexpectedly cross and prickly. She hadn't thought her own feelings were still so near the surface, and didn't like either the fact that they were, or that Roger could see that they were. Well, yes. She glanced at the cradle. Jem had moved. He was curled up like a hedgehog now, with his face pressed to his knees, and nothing visible save the curve of his bottom under his nightshirt, rising over the edge of the cradle, like the moon rising above the horizon. You're right. We'd have to wait until he's old enough to realize that he can't tell people, that it's a secret. The leather thong fell out of a shaken quilt. He bent to pick it up, dark hair falling round his face.
"Would you want to tell Jem some day that I'm not his real father?" he asked quietly, not looking at her.
"Roger!" All her crossness disappeared in a flood of panic. "I wouldn't do that in 100 million years, even if I thought it was true," she added hastily. "And I don't. Roger, I don't. I know you're his father." She sat down beside him, gripping his arm urgently. He smiled, a little crookedly, and patted her hand, but he wouldn't meet her eyes. He waited a moment, then moved, gently disengaging himself in order to tie up his hair.
"What you said, though, has he not got a right to know who he is?"
"That's not... it's different." It was, and yet it wasn't. The act that had resulted in her own conception hadn't been rape, but it had been just as unintended. On the other hand, there had been no doubt either. Both, well, all three of her parents, had known that she was Jamie Fraser's child, beyond doubt. With Jem. She looked again at the cradle, instinctively wanting to find some stamp, some undeniable clue to his paternity. But he looked like her, and like her father, in terms both of colouring and feature. He was big for his age, long-limbed and broad-backed. But so were both of the men who might have fathered him. And both, damn them, had green eyes. "I'm not telling him that," she said firmly. "Not ever, and neither are you. You are his father in any way that matters. And there wouldn't be any good reason for him to even know that Stephen Bonnet exists."
"Save that he does exist," Roger pointed out, "and he thinks the wean is his. What if they should meet some day? When Jem's older, I mean."
She had not grown up with the habit of crossing herself at moments of stress as her father and cousin did, but she did it now, making him laugh. "I'm not being funny," she said, sitting up straight. "It's not happening. And if it did, if I ever saw Stephen Bonnet anywhere near my child, I'd... well, next time I'll aim higher, that's all."
"You're determined to give the lad a good story for his classmates, aren't you?"
He spoke lightly, teasing, and she relaxed a little, hoping that she had succeeded in easing any doubt he might have about what she might tell Jemmy regarding his paternity.
"Okay, but he does have to know the rest, sooner or later. I don't want him to find out by accident." "You didn't find out by accident. Your mother did tell you. And look where we are now."
That bit went unspoken, but rang loud inside her head as he gave her a long, straight look. If she hadn't felt compelled to come back, to go through the stones to find her real father, none of them would be here now. They'd be safe in the 20th century, perhaps in Scotland, perhaps in America, but in a place where children didn't die of diarrhea and sudden fevers. In a place where sudden danger didn't lurk behind every tree and war wasn't hiding under the bushes. A place where Roger's voice still sang pure and strong. But maybe,
just maybe, she wouldn't have Jem.
I'm sorry, she said, feeling choked. I know it's my fault, all of it. If I hadn't come back...
She reached out tentatively and touched the ragged scar that circled his throat. He caught her hand and pulled it down.
Christ, he said softly. If I could have gone anywhere to find either of my parents, including hell, Brianna, I would have done it.
He looked up, his eyes bright green, and squeezed her hand hard.
If there's anyone in this world who understands that, Hen, it's me.
She squeezed back with both hands hard. Relief that he didn't blame her loosened the cords of her body, but sorrow, for his own losses and hers, still filled throat and chest, heavy as wet feathers, and it hurt to breathe. Jemmy stirred, rose suddenly upright, then fell back, still sound asleep, so that one arm flopped out of the cradle, limp as a noodle. She'd frozen at his sudden movement, but now relaxed and rose to try to tuck the arm back in. Before she could reach the cradle, though, a knock came at the door. Roger grabbed hastily for his shirt with one hand, his knife with the other. "Who is it?" she called, heart-thumping. People didn't pay calls after dark, save in emergency.
"It's me, Miss Bree," said Lizzie's voice through the wood. "Can we come in, please?"
She sounded excited, but not alarmed.
Brianna waited to be sure that Roger was decently covered, then lifted the heavy bolt.
Her first thought was that Lizzie looked excited, too. The little bond maid's cheeks were flushed as apples, the colour visible even in the darkness of the stoop. We was herself and the two Beardsleys, who bowed and nodded, murmuring apologies for the lateness of the hour.
"Not at all," Brianna said automatically, glancing around for a shawl. Not only was her linen shift thin and ratty, it had an incriminating stain on the front.
Come in.
Roger came forward to greet the unexpected guests, magnificently disregarding the fact that he was wearing nothing but a shirt, and she scuttled hastily into the dark corner behind her loom, groping for the ancient shawl she kept there as comfort for her legs while working. Safely wrapped in this, she kicked a log to break the fire and stooped to light a candle from the fiery coals. In the wavering glow of the candlelight, she could see that the Beardsleys were dressed with unaccustomed neatness, their hair combed and firmly plaited, each with a clean shirt and a leather vest, but they didn't own coats. Lizzie was dressed in her best, too. In fact, she was wearing the pale peach woolen dress they had made for her wedding. Something was up, and it was fairly obvious what, as Lizzie buzzed earnestly into Roger's ear.
"You want me to marry you?" Roger said, in tones of astonishment.
He glanced from one twin to the other.
To whom?
"Aye, sir."
Lizzie bobbed a respectful curtsy.
"It's me and Joser, if you'd be so kind. Kezzy's come to be witness."
Roger rubbed a hand over his face, looking baffled.
"Well, but..."
He gave Brianna a pleading look.
"Are you in trouble, Lizzie?"
Brianna asked directly, lighting a second candle and putting it in the sconce by the door. With more light, she could see that Lizzie's eyelids were reddened and swollen, as though she had been crying, though her attitude was one of excited determination rather than fear.
"Not to say trouble exactly, but I'm wee child, aye?"
Lizzie crossed her hands on her belly, protective.
We wanted to be married before I tell anyone."
"Oh, well."
Roger gave Joe a disapproving look, but appeared no more than half convinced.
"But your father, won't he?"
"Ta would want us to be married by a priest," Lizzie explained earnestly, "and so we will be. But you can, sir. It'll be months, maybe years, before we can find one."
She cast down her eyes, blushing.
I should like to be married with proper words, Ken. Before the babe comes?"
"Yes," he said, eyes drawn ineluctably to Lizzie's midsection. "I grasp that. but I didn't quite understand the rush, if you take my meaning. I mean, you won't be noticeably more pregnant tomorrow than you are tonight. Or next week.
Joe and Kezzy exchanged glances over Lizzie's head. Then Joe put his hand on Lizzie's waist and drew her gently to him.
Sir, it's only... we want to do right by each other, but we'd like it to be private, see? Just me and Lizzie and my brother.
Just us, Kezzy echoed, drawing close. He looked earnestly at Roger.
Please, sir.
He seemed to have injured his hand somehow. There was a handkerchief wound round it.
Brianna found the three of them touching almost beyond bearing. They were so innocent and so young. The three scrubbed faces turned earnestly up to Roger in supplication. She moved closer and touched Roger's arm, warm through the cloth of his sleeve.
"Do it for them," she said softly. "Please."
"It's not a marriage exactly, but you can make them handfast."
"Aye, well, but they ought to be counselled. Her father..."
His protests trailed off as he glanced from her toward the trio, and she could see that he was as much touched by their innocence as she was. And, she thought, privately amused, he was also very much drawn by the thought of performing his first wedding, unorthodox as it might be. The circumstances would be romantic and memorable here in the quiet of the night, vows exchanged by the light of fire and candle, with the memory of their own lovemaking warm in the shadows, and the sleeping child a silent witness, both blessing and promise for the new marriage to be made. Roger sighed deeply, then smiled at her in resignation, and turned away.
"Aye, all right then. Let me put my breeches on, though. I'm not conducting my first wedding bare-arsed."
Roger held a spoon of marmalade over his slice of toast, staring at me.
"They what?"
he said, in a strangled tone.
"Oh, she didn't."
Bree clapped a hand to her mouth, eyes wide above it, removing it at once to ask,
"Both of them?"
"Evidently so," I said, suppressing a most disgraceful urge to laugh. "You really married her to Joe last night?"
"God help me, I did,"
Roger muttered. Looking thoroughly rattled, he put the spoon in his coffee cup and stirred mechanically.
"But she's handfast with Kezzy too?"
"Before witnesses," I assured him, with a wary glance at Mr. Weems, who was sitting across the breakfast table, mouth open and apparently turned to stone.
"Do you think," Bree said to me, "I mean, both of them? At once?"
"She said not," I replied, cutting my eyes towards Mr. Weems as an indication that perhaps this was not a suitable question to be considering in his presence, fascinating as it was.
"Oh, God,"
Mr. Weems said, in a voice from the sepulchre.
"She is damned."
"Holy Mary, Mother of God," Mrs. Bugg, saucer-eyed, crossed herself. "May Christ have mercy."
Roger took a gulp of his coffee, choked, and put it down, spluttering. Brianna pounded him helpfully on the back, but he motioned her away, eyes watering, and pulled himself together.
"Now, it's maybe not so bad as it seems," he said to Mr. Weems, trying to find a bright side to look on. "I mean, one could maybe make a case that the twins are one soul that God's put into two bodies for purposes of his own."
"Aye? But two bodies," Mrs. Bugg said. "Do you think both at once?"
"I don't know," I said, giving up. "But I imagine..."
I glanced at the window, where the snow whispered at the closed shutter. It had begun to snow heavily the night before, a thick, wet snow. By now, there was nearly a foot of it on the ground, and I was reasonably sure that everyone at the table was imagining exactly what I was. A vision of Lizzie and the Beardsley twins, tucked up cosily in a warm bed of furs by a blazing fire, enjoying their honeymoon.
"Well, I don't suppose there's actually much anybody can do about it," Bree said practically. "If we say anything in public, the Presbyterians will probably stone Lizzie as a papist whore, and..."
Mr. Weems made a sound like a stepped-on pig's bladder.
Certainly no one will say anything.
Roger fixed Mrs. Bug with a hard look.
Will they?
Well, I'll have to tell Archmind, or I'll burst, she said frankly. But no one else. Silent as the grave, I swear it, deal take me if I lie.
She put both hands over her mouth in illustration, and Roger nodded.
I suppose, he said dubiously, that the marriage I performed isn't actually valid as such. But then...
It's certainly as valid as the hand-fasting Jamie did, I said. And besides, I think it's too late to force her to choose. Once Kezzy's thumb heals, no one will be able to tell.
Except Lizzie, probably, Bree said. She licked a smear of honey from the corner of her mouth, regarding Roger thoughtfully.
I wonder what it would be like if there were two of you.
We'd both of us be thoroughly bamboozled, he assured her. Mrs. Bug, is there any more coffee? Who's bamboozled?
The kitchen door opened in a swirl of snow and frigid air, and Jamie came in with Jem, both fresh from a visit to the privy, ruddy-faced, their hair and lashes thick with melting snowflakes.
You, for one. You've just been done in the eye by a 19-year-old bigamist, I informed him.
What's a bigamist?
Jem inquired.
A very large young lady, Roger said, taking a piece of buttered toast and thrusting it into Jem's mouth. Here, why don't you take that and...
His voice died away as he realized that he couldn't send Jem outside.
Lizzie and the twins came round to Roger's last night, and he married her to Joe, I told Jamie.
He blinked, water from the melting snow on his lashes running down his face.
I will be damned, he said.
He took a long breath, then realized he was still covered with snow, and went to shake himself at the hearth, bits of snow falling into the fire with a sputter and hiss.
Well, he said, coming back to the table and sitting down beside me, at least your grandson will have a name, Joseph. It's Beardsley, either way.
This ridiculous observation seemed actually to comfort Mr. Weems a bit. A small bit of colour came back to his cheeks, and he allowed Mrs. Bug to put a fresh bannock on his plate.
"Aye, I suppose that's something," he said, "and I really cannot see."
"Come, look,"
Jemmy was saying, tugging impatiently on Bree's arm.
"Come see, Mama."
"See what?"
"I wrote my name. Granda showed me."
"Oh, you did?
Well, good for you."
Brianna beamed at him, then her brow furrowed.
"What? Just now?"
"Yes. Come and see before it's covered up."
She looked at Jamie under lowered brows.
"Duh, you didn't."
He took a fresh piece of toast from the platter and spread it neatly with butter.
"Aye, well," he said, "there's got to be some advantage still to being a man, even if no one pays a bit of heed to what you say. Will you pass the marmalade, Roger Mac?"
Chapter 75 Lice Jem put his elbows on the table, chin on his fists, following the path of the spoon through the batter with the intent expression of a lion watching an appetizing wildebeest on its way to the waterhole.
"Don't even think about it," I said, with a glance at his grubby fingers. "They'll be done in a few minutes. You can have one then."
"But I like them raw, Grandma," he protested.
He widened his dark blue eyes in wordless pleading.
"You oughtn't to eat raw things," I said sternly. "They can make you sick."
"You do, Grandma?"
He poked a finger at my mouth where a smudge of brownish batter remained. I cleared my throat and wiped the incriminating evidence on a towel.
"You'll spoil your supper," I said.
But with the acuity of any jungle beast, he sensed the weakening of his prey.
"Promise I won't. I'll eat everything," he said,
already reaching for the spoon.
"Yes, that's what I'm afraid of," I said, relinquishing it with some reluctance. "Just a taste now. Leave some for your daddy and granda."
He nodded, wordless, and licked the spoon with a long, slow swipe of the tongue, closing his eyes in ecstasy.
I found another spoon and set about dropping the cookies onto the tin sheets I used for baking. We ended in a dead heat, the sheets full and the bowl quite empty, just as footsteps came down the hallway toward the door. Recognizing Brianna's tread, I snatched the empty spoon from Jemmy and rubbed a quick towel across his smudgy mouth. Bree stopped in the doorway, her smile turning to a look of suspicion.
"What are you guys doing?"
"Making molasses cookies," I said, lifting the plates in evidence before sliding them into the brick oven set in the wall of the fireplace. "Jemmy's been helping me." One neat red brow arched upward. She glanced from me to Jemmy, who was wearing a look of sublimely unnatural innocence. I gathered my own expression was no more convincing.
"So I see," she said dryly.
"How much batter did you eat, Jem?"
"Who, me?"
Jemmy said, eyes going wide. She leaned forward and picked a speck out of his wavy red hair.
"What's this, then?"
He frowned at it, crossing his eyes slightly in the attempt to focus.
"Are you a big louse?" he suggested brightly. "Reckon I got it from Rabbi MacLeod."
"Rabbi MacLeod?" I said, uneasily aware that Rabbi had been curled up on the kitchen settle a few days ago, his unruly black curls flowing into Jemmy's bright locks as the boys slept, waiting for their fathers. I recalled thinking at the time how charming the little boys looked, curled up head to head, their faces soft with dreaming.
"Has Rabbi got lice?" Bree demanded,
flicking the bit of batter away from her as though it were indeed a loathsome insect.
"Oh, aye, he's crawling,"
Jemmy assured her cheerfully.
"His mum says she's going to get his daddy's razor and shave off every bit of his hair, him and his brothers and his daddy and his Uncle Roof too. She says they got lice hopping all over their bed. She's tired of being ate up alive."
Quite casually, he lifted a hand to his head and scratched, fingers raking through his hair in a characteristic gesture I had seen all too often before. Bree and I exchanged a brief look of horror. Then she seized Jemmy by the shoulders, dragging him over to the window. "Come here." Sure enough, exposed to the brilliant light bouncing off the snow, the tender skin behind his ears and on the back of his neck showed the characteristic pinkness caused by scratching for lice. And a quick inspection of his head revealed the worst, tiny nits clinging to the base of the hairs, and a few reddish-brown adult lice, half the size of rice grains, who scrambled madly away into the thickets. Bree caught one and cracked it between her thumbnails, tossing the remains into the fire.
"Ugh!"
She rubbed her hands on her skirt, then pulled off the ribbon that tied back her hair, scratching vigorously.
"Have I got them?"
she asked anxiously, thrusting the crown of her head toward me. I ruffled quickly through the thick mass of auburn and cinnamon, looking for the telltale whitish nits, then stepped back, bending my own head.
"No, have I?"
The back door opened, and Jamie stepped in, looking only mildly surprised to find Brianna picking through my hair like a crazed baboon. Then his head jerked up, sniffing the air. "Is something burning?"
"I got him, Granda."
The exclamation reached me together with the scent of singeing molasses. I jerked upright and banged my head on the edge of the dish shelf hard enough to make me see stars. These cleared just in time for me to see Jemmy standing on tiptoe as he reached into the smoking oven in the wall of the hearth well over his head. His eyes were squinched shut with concentration. His face turned away from the waves of heat coming off the brick, and he had a towel wound clumsily round the groping hand. Jamie reached the boy with two strides, jerking him back by the collar. He reached into the oven bare-handed and yanked out a sheet of smoking cookies, flinging the hot sheet away with such force that it struck the wall. Small brown discs flew off and scattered over the floor. Adso, who had been perched in the window, helping with the louse hunt, saw what looked like prey and pounced fiercely on a fleeing cookie, which promptly burned his paws. Uttering a startled yowl, he dropped it and raced under the settle. Jamie, shaking his scorched fingers and making extremely vulgar remarks in Gaelic, had seized a stick of kindling in his other hand and was poking into the oven,
trying to extract the remaining cookie sheet amid clouds of smoke.
What's going...
Hey! Jimmy!
Roger's cry coincided with Bree's. Coming in on Jamie's heels, Roger's expression of bewilderment had changed at once to alarm at sight of his offspring crouched on the floor, industriously collecting cookies, and oblivious of the fact that his trailing towel was smouldering in the ashes of the cookfire. Roger lunged for Jemmy, colliding with Bree on the same course. The two of them cannoned into Jamie, who had just manoeuvred the second sheet of cookies to the edge of the oven. He reeled, staggering off balance, and the sheet clanged into the hearth, scattering lumps of smoking, molasses-scented charcoal. The cauldron, knocked askew, swung and shifted perilously on its hook, splashing soup into the coals and sending up clouds of hissing, savoury steam. I didn't know whether to laugh or run out of the door, but settled for snatching up the towel, which had burst into flames, and beating it out on the stone-flagged hearth. I stood up, panting, to find that my family had now managed to extricate itself from the fireplace. Roger had a squirming Jemmy in a death grip against his chest, while Bree frisked the child for burns, flames, and broken bones. Jamie, looking rather annoyed, was sucking on a blistered finger, waving smoke away from his face with his free hand. "Cold water," I said, addressing the most immediate exigency. I grasped Jamie by the arm, pulled the finger out of his mouth, and stabbed it into the washbowl. "Is Jamie all right?" I asked, turning to the happy family's tableau by the window. "Yes, I see he is. Do put him down, Roger. The child has lice." Roger dropped Jemmy like a hot potato, and, in the usual adult reaction to hearing the word lice, scratched himself. Jemmy, unaffected by the recent commotion, sat down on the floor and began to eat one of the cookies he had kept clutched in his hand throughout. "You'll spoil your..." Brianna began automatically, then caught sight of the spilled cauldron and the puddled hearth, glanced at me, and shrugged. "Got any more cookies?" she asked Jemmy. Mouthful, he nodded, reached into his shirt, and handed her one. She viewed it critically, but took a bite anyway. "Not bad," she said, through crumbs. "Hm?" She held the remnant out to Roger, who wolfed it one-handed, using the other to poke through Jemmy's hair.
"It's going round," he said. "At least we saw half a dozen lads near Sinclair's, all shaved like convicts." "Shall we have to shave your head, then?" he asked, smiling at Jemmy and ruffling the boy's hair.
The boy's face lighted up at that suggestion.
"Will I be bald, like Grandma?"
"Yes, even balder," I assured him tartly. I had, in fact, got a good 2-inch crop at the moment, though the curliness made it look shorter, little waves and swirls hugging the curves of my skull.
"Shave his head?"
Brianna looked aghast. She turned to me. "Isn't there any other good way to get rid of lice?" I looked consideringly at Jemmy's head. He had the same thick, slightly wavy hair as his mother and grandfather. I glanced at Jamie, who grinned at me, one hand in the washbowl. He knew from experience just how long it took to knit-comb that sort of hair. I'd done it for him many times. He shook his head.
"Shave him," he said. "You'll not get a lad that size to sit still long enough to comb."
"We could use lard," I suggested dubiously. "You plaster his head with lard or bear grease and leave it for a few days. It suffocates the lice. Or at least you hope so." "Ack!" Brianna viewed her son's head with disfavour, obviously envisioning the havoc he could wreak on clothes and linens if allowed to roam at large while plastered with lard. "Vinegar and a fine comb will get out the big ones," I said, coming to peer down at the fine white line of the parting through Jemmy's ruddy hair. "It doesn't get the nits, though. You have to scrape those off with your fingernails. Or else wait till they hatch and comb them out."
"Shave him,"
Roger said, shaking his head.
"You never get all the nits. You have to do it over again every few days. And if you miss a few that grow big enough to hop..."
He grinned and flicked a cookie crumb off his thumbnail. It bounced off Bree's skirt, and she slapped it away, glowering at Roger. "You're a big help." She bit her lip, frowning, then nodded reluctantly.
All right, then. I suppose there's no help for it.
It will grow back, I assured her. Jamie went upstairs to fetch his razor. I went to the surgery to get my surgical scissors and a bottle of oil of lavender for Jamie's burned finger. By the time I came back, Bree and Roger had their heads together over what looked like a newspaper.
"What's that?" I asked, coming to peer over Brianna's shoulder.
"Fergus's maiden effort."
Roger smiled up at me and moved the paper so I could see.
"He sent it up with a trader who left it at Sinclair's for Jimmy."
"Really? That's wonderful." I craned my neck to see, and a small thrill went through me at the sight of the bold headline across the top of the page. "The New Bern Union." Then I looked closer.
"Onion?" I said, blinking.
"The Onion?"
"Well, he explains that," Roger said, pointing to an ornately embellished remarks by the proprietor in the center of the page, the legend upheld by a couple of floating cherubim. "It's to do with onions having layers. Complexity, you see. And the,
His finger ran down the line.
"The pungency and savour of the reasoned discourse always to be exercised herein for the complete information and amusement of our purchasers and readers."
"I notice he makes a distinction between purchasers and readers," I remarked. "Very French of him."
"Well, yes," Roger agreed. "There's a distinctly Gallic tone to some of the pieces. But you can see that Massali must have had a hand in it. And of course, most of the advertisements were written by the people who placed them."
He pointed to one small item headed "Lost, a hat. If found in good condition, please return to the subscriber, S. Gowdy, New Bern. If not in good condition, wear it yourself." Jamie arrived with his razor in time to hear this and joined in the laughter. He poked a finger down the page at another item.
"Aye, that's good. But I think the Poet's Corner is maybe my favourite. Fergus couldn't have done it, I dinna think. He's no ear for rhyme at all. Was it Massali, do you think, or someone else?"
"Read it out loud," Brianna said, reluctantly relinquishing the paper to Roger. "I better clip Jemmy before he gets away and spreads lice all over Fraser's Ridge." Once resigned to the prospect, Brianna didn't hesitate, but tied a dishcloth round Jemmy's neck and set to with the scissors in a determined fashion that sent strands of red gold and auburn falling to the floor like shimmering rain. Meanwhile, Roger read out with dramatic flourishes,
"On the late act against retailing spirituous liquors, etc. Tell me, can it be understood this act intends the public good? No, truly, I deny it. For if, as all allow 'tis best, of evils too to choose the least, then my opinion's right. Suppose on search it should appear 10 bunters died in every year by drinking to excess. Should thousands innocent be led into despair and lose their bread, such folly to redress? I'd not be thought to encourage sin or be an advocate of gin, but humbly do conceive. The scheme, though drawn with nicest care, don't with almighty justice square, if scriptures we believe. When Sodom's sin for vengeance called, 10 righteous had its doom forestalled, and moved e'en God to pity. But now 10 bare-faced debauchees some private epicures displease, and ruin half a city."
"I'd not be thought to encourage sin, or be an advocate of gin," Bree repeated, giggling.
"You notice he, or she, doesn't mention whiskey. What's a bunter, though? Whoops. Hold still, baby."
"A harlot," Jamie said absently, stropping his razor while still reading over Roger's shoulder.
"What's a harlot?" Jamie asked, his radar naturally picking up the single indelicate word in the conversation. "Is it Richie's sister?"
Richard Woolham's sister, Charlotte, was a most attractive young person. She was also a most devout Quaker. Jamie exchanged glances with Roger and coughed.
"No, I should na think it, lad," he said. And for God's sake, don't say so either. Here, are you ready to be shaved?
Not waiting for an answer, he picked up the shaving brush and lathered Jemmy's polled head to the accompaniment of delighted squeals.
Barber, barber, shave a pig, Bree said, watching. How many hairs to make a wig?
Lots, I replied,
sweeping up the drifts of fallen hair and throwing them into the fire, hopefully to the destruction of all resident lice.
It was rather a pity. Jemmy's hair was beautiful.
Still, it would grow again, and the clipping showed off the lovely shape of his head, roundly pleasing as a cantaloupe. Jamie hummed tunelessly under his breath, drawing the razor over the skin of his grandson's head with as much delicacy as if he'd been shaving a honeybee. Jamie turned his head slightly, and I caught my breath, struck by a fleeting memory. Jamie, his hair clipped short against his skull in Paris, readying himself to meet Jack Randall, readying himself to kill or be killed. Then Jemmy turned again, squirming on his stool, and the vision vanished, to be replaced by something else.
Whatever is that?
I leaned forward to look as Jamie drew his razor down with a flourish and flicked away the last dollop of lava into the fire.
What?
Bree leaned in beside me, and her eyes widened at sight of the small brown blotch. It was about the size of a farthing, quite round, just above the hairline toward the back of his head, behind the left ear.
"What is it?"
she asked, frowning. She touched it gently, but Jemmy scarcely noticed. He was squirming even more, wanting to get down.
"I'm fairly sure it's all right," I assured her, after a quick inspection. "It looks like what's called a nevus. It's something like a flat mole, usually quite harmless."
Where did it come from? I wasn't born with it, I know, she protested.
Babies very seldom have any sort of mole, I explained, untying my dishcloth from round Jemmy's neck.
All right, yes,
you're done.
Go and be good now. We'll have supper as soon as I can manage.
No, I added, turning back to Bree. Moles usually start to develop around 3 years of age, though, of course, people can get more as they grow older. Free from restraint, Jemmy was rubbing his naked head with both hands, looking pleased, and chanting,
"Charlotte the harlot, Charlotte the harlot,"
quietly under his breath.
"You're sure it's all right?"
Brianna was still frowning, worried.
"It isn't dangerous."
"Oh, hi, it's nothing,"
Roger assured her, glancing up from the newspaper.
"I've had one just like that myself, ever since I was a kid, just... here."
His face changed abruptly as he spoke, and his hand rose, very slowly, to rest on the back of his head, just above the hairline, behind the left ear. He looked at me, and I saw his throat move as he swallowed, the jagged rope scar dark against the sudden paleness of his skin. The down hairs rose silently on my arms.
"Yes," I said,
answering the look, and hoping my voice didn't shake too noticeably.
"That sort of mark is
often hereditary." Jamie said nothing, but his hand closed on mine, squeezing tight. Jemmy was on his hands and knees now, trying to coax Adso out from under the settle. His neck was small and fragile, and his shaven head looked unearthly white and shockingly naked, like a mushroom poking out of the earth. Roger's eyes rested on it for a moment, then he turned to Bree.
"I do believe, perhaps, I've picked up a few lice myself," he said,
his voice just a tiny bit too loud. He reached up, pulled off the thong that bound his thick black hair, and scratched his head vigorously with both hands. Then he picked up the scissors, smiling, and held them out to her.
"Like father, like son, I suppose. Give us a hand here, aye?"
Part 10. Where's Perry Mason when you need him? Chapter 76.
Dangerous Correspondence.
From Mount Josiah Plantation in the Colony of Virginia, Lord John Grey to Mr. James Fraser, Esquire, Fraser's Ridge, North Carolina, upon the 6th of March, Anno Domini, 1775. Dear Mr. Fraser, what in the name of God are you about? I have known you in the course of our long acquaintance to be many things, intemperate and stubborn being two of them, but have always known you for a man of intelligence and honour. Yet despite explicit warnings, I find your name upon more than one list of suspected traitors and seditionists associated with illegal assemblies, and thus subject to arrest. The fact that you are still at liberty, my friend, reflects nothing more than the lack of troops at present available in North Carolina, and that may change rapidly. Josiah Martin has implored London for help, and it will be forthcoming, I assure you. Was Gage not more than sufficiently occupied in Boston, and Lord Dunsmore's Virginia troops still in process of assembly, the army would be upon you within a few months. Do not delude yourself. The king may be misguided in his actions, but the government perceives, if belatedly, the level of turmoil in the colonies, and is moving as rapidly as may be to suppress it before greater harm can ensue. Whatever else you may be, you are no fool, and so I must assume you realize the consequences of your actions. But I would be less than a friend did I not put the case to you bluntly. You expose your family to the utmost danger by your actions, and you put your own head in a noose. For the sake of whatever affection you may yet bear me, and for the sake of those dear connections between your family and myself, I beg you to renounce these most dangerous associations while there is still time. John.
I read the letter through, then looked up at Jamie. He was sitting at his desk, papers strewn in every direction, scattered with the small brown fragments of broken sealing wax. Bobby Higgins had brought a good many letters, newspapers and packages. Jamie had put off reading Lord John's letter till the last.
"He's very much afraid for you," I said, putting the single sheet of paper down on top of the rest.
Jamie nodded.
"For a man of his parts to refer to the king's actions as possibly misguided is very close to treason, Sassenach," he observed,
though I thought he was joking.
"These lists he mentions, do you know anything about that?"
He shrugged at that and poked through one of the untidy piles with a forefinger, pulling out a smeared sheet that had obviously been dropped in a puddle at some point.
"Like that, I suppose," he said, handing it over.
It was unsigned and nearly illegible. A misspelt and vicious denunciation of various outrages and debauched persons, he listed, whose speech, action, and appearance was a threat to all who valued peace and prosperity. These, the writer felt, should be shown what's what, presumably by being beaten, skinned alive, rolled in boiling tar and placed on a rail, or in particularly pernicious cases, hanged outright from their own roof trees.
"Where did you pick that up?"
"I dropped it on the desk, using two fingers."
"In Campbellton. Someone sent it to Farquhar as Justice of the Peace. He gave it to me because my name is on it."
"Is it?"
I squinted at the straggling letters.
"Oh, so it is. J. Fraser. You sure it's you? There are quite a few Frasers, after all, and not a few named John, James, Jacob, or Joseph."
"Relatively few who could be described as a red-haired degenerate, pox-ridden, usuring son of a bitch who skulks in brothels when not drunk and committing riot in the street, I imagine."
"Oh, I missed that part."
"It's in the exposition at the bottom."
He gave the paper a brief, indifferent glance.
"I think Buck and the Butcher wrote it myself."
"Always assuming that usuring is a word. I don't see where he gets that bit. You haven't any money to lend."
"I wouldn't suppose a basis in truth is strictly required under the circumstances, Sassenach," he said very dryly. "And thanks to MacDonald and wee Bobby, there are a good many folk who think I do have money, and if I'm not inclined to lend it to them, why then
plainly, it's a matter of my having put my fortune all in the hands of Jews and Whig speculators, as I am intent upon ruining trade for my own profit."
"What?"
"That was a somewhat more literary effort," he said, shuffling through the pile and pulling out an elegant parchment sheet done in a copperplate hand. This one had been sent to a newspaper in Hillsborough and was signed "A Friend to Justice," and while it didn't name Jamie, it was clear who the subject of the denunciation was.
"It's the hair," I said, looking critically at him. "If you wore a wig, they'd have a much harder time of it."
He lifted one shoulder in a sardonic shrug. The commonly held view of red hair as an indicator of low character and moral coarseness, if not outright demonic possession, was by no means limited to anonymous ill-wishers. The knowledge of that view, together with personal disinclination, had quite a bit to do with the fact that he never did wear either wig or powder, even in situations where a proper